Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It's Friday, May 6th. We have new reporting this morning on the role U.S. intelligence is playing in Ukraine's success on the battlefield, including the sinking of Russia's most lethal warship and the concern among some U.S. officials about Vladimir Putin's response to that. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby joins us later this morning to weigh in as fighting rages on inside that sprawling steel plant in Mariupol. Also happening this morning, Senate Democrats don't have the numbers, but they've scheduled a vote anyway to codify abortion rights into federal law. They don't have the votes. We'll show you what key senators are saying about the legislation and what the strategy is here. Plus, whiplash on Wall Street. The Dow suffered its worst day since 2020, erasing gains from the day before and increasing concerns a recession could be ahead. And former Defense Secretary under President Trump, Mark Esper, speaking out about the time Trump wanted to launch missiles into Mexico. We'll have the story from Esper's new memoir as reported in the New York Times. Staggering. We'll have all that and much more ahead. Joe's under the weather this morning. Along with Willie and me, we have MSNBC contributor Mike Barnicle and president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, with us. So let's begin with the new reporting that Vladimir Putin's most embarrassing loss to Ukrainian forces came out of shared intelligence from the United States. The Moskva, Russia's premier warship in the Black Sea, sank 3 weeks ago after it was hit by missiles fired by the Ukrainians. Moscow claims it sank because a fire on board caused ammunition to explode. U.S. officials tell NBC News that the attack happened after Ukrainian forces asked American intelligence about a ship sailing in the Black Sea. The U.S. confirmed it was the Moskva and gave the Ukrainians its location. The officials said the U.S. was not involved in the decision to strike the warship, but Willie, this obviously raises a number of questions.
It absolutely does. And Richard Haass has a few thoughts about that in just a moment. This, remember, comes just a day after that New York Times reporting that senior officials told that paper American intelligence has been used to help Ukrainian forces kill Russian generals. Ukraine claims to have killed 12 generals on the front lines. American officials did not give a specific number of deaths that were the result of the shared information. The officials pushed back against the idea that the U.S. was explicitly providing the information with the intent of targeting Russian military leaders. Yesterday, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby clarified how the U.S. shares intelligence with Ukraine.
We do not provide intelligence on the location of senior military leaders on the battlefield or participate in the targeting decisions of the Ukrainian military. The Ukrainians have, quite frankly, a lot more information than we do. This is their country, their territory, and they have capable intelligence collection abilities of their own. Ukraine combines information that we and other partners provide with the intelligence that they themselves are gathering on the battlefield. And then they make their own decisions and they take their own actions.
As Mika mentioned, Admiral Kirby will join us this morning at the top of our third hour. Let's bring in co-author of the exclusive reporting on the Moskva, NBC News White House correspondent Carol Lee. Carol, good morning. It's great to see you. So how did this come to pass? And I guess the question for you on the reporting side of it is, why do you suspect that American officials are so interested in getting the word out publicly that they are helping and directly in this war effort against Russia and perhaps providing Vladimir Putin with some of the propaganda that he craves?
Sure, Willie. Well, the way it came about is, as you recall, there was a lot of speculation when this ship sank on April 14th about whether Ukraine had help in sinking that ship. And what we've learned from U.S. officials is that they did, that the U.S. helped them identify and locate this ship. And after the Ukrainians had asked the U.S. about a ship that was sailing in the Black Sea south of Odessa, And the U.S. responded and said that it was the Moskva and that here was where it was located. What U.S. officials say then is that they didn't know what that Ukraine was going to then launch these missile strikes on the ship and that the U.S. didn't play a role in that specifically. So there's a little bit of trying to distance themselves from that, even though we know that they provided the intelligence. And the result of this was one of the most humiliating moments for the Russians in this Ukrainian conflict, and also a big morale boost for the Ukrainian forces. And I think to your question about why people are talking about this now is there's, you know, we're reporters. We want people to tell us things that maybe other people don't want out there in the public. But there's been a lot of focus on the military, the actual equipment that's been provided to Ukraine. And there's this whole other piece that's happening that's really helped the Ukrainians get on the footing that they're on at this particular time. And we reported last week, for instance, about other elements of intelligence sharing that have allowed the Ukrainians to avoid having some of their missile defense systems struck, to really put them on a better offensive than anyone would have thought. And so I think at this point, there's a little bit of distance there. And the concern, though, is among some officials in the U.S. government is that this could be provocative if this is out there in the public. And look, part of this is Vladimir Putin isn't stupid. I mean, there was plenty of speculation about this. He can put things together on his own, but having it out there, having it talked about sort of adds to that humiliation. And so there's concern that there could be some sort of reaction. And then on the Ukrainian side, you've heard some officials, including former officials, say that this is something that they don't like because it just makes them look like they don't know exactly what they're doing.
So I want to keep Carol for her great reporting and more questions there. But Richard Haass, there always is this question of whether or not, oh, the Russians will see this as the beginning of World War. They will take this as the United States getting involved or NATO getting involved. But we really don't know where that line is. I mean, and so the question is, first of all, what's the point of releasing this information? But secondly, what does it matter? Because Russia is going to decide what that line is.
Well, the point of releasing this information is there is no point. This is just a lack of judgment and a lack of discipline. A little bit of the old World War II, loose lips sink ships. This is just what bureaucracies do. They leak. I think the danger here is twofold. If one of our goals, as the Secretary of Defense said, is to weaken the Russians, I'm not a big fan of saying that publicly, but this gives Putin an argument. He's not losing to Ukraine. He's losing to the United States and the West. So it actually makes it easier for him to defend or explain why Russia's run into all sorts of difficulties. Second of all, if we're going to be a direct protagonist in this war, then it seems to me it weakens some of the barriers against escalation. And obviously, we don't want that to happen. Plus, if you heard the Ukrainians, this in some ways takes it away from them. We want the focus here, Mika, to be on Ukraine, their defense against an aggressive Russia. Why do we want to put the microscope on ourselves?
And Mike, this, as we've been talking about the last couple of days with the New York Times report on intelligence, perhaps leading to the death of these generals, this is all of a piece of what the United States is providing to Ukraine. It's physical equipment, yes, but it's also training and it's intelligence.
It certainly is, and it has been since the inception of this war, Willie. But I have to tell you, I've been a bit surprised. I think, Richard, perhaps you were surprised as well at the length of cooperation involved in the story yesterday in the Times and the story today about the Russian ship. And, Carol, I'm wondering, at the start of this war, there was a lot of reluctance when you would ask about our helping them, helping the Ukrainians with targeting, with intelligence, with almost the immediate amputation of the Russian command and control capacity, but it's specifically about targeting. The people I spoke to would say, no, we're not going to talk about targeting. We're not going to talk about that. What has happened, do you think, to clearly open the door to cooperation with members of the media, reporters like you and others, to get these stories out with our thumbprint all over it?
Well, I think there's been first of all, some time has gone by, right? So that always, when you have distance from specific events, that can make a difference. But this is also something that the U.S. has been a little bit more public about. There have been conversations about intelligence sharing when members of the administration have testified on Capitol Hill. There was some real questions raised by, and the administration was put on the defensive when there were real questions raised by members of the Intelligence Committee about whether the U.S. was sharing enough intelligence. The Ukrainians at times have complained about not getting enough information. So I think all of that combined, and then, you know, I can't speak to people's motivations or where our sourcing came from, but this is an aspect of the conflict that is playing a very significant role. And it's not something that to this point has been talked about so much. And now that the conflict is going on for months and it's continuing to drag on, there seems to be a more willingness to put this out there. I will also say that there's so much more that we don't know, and that, you know, there are things that we do know that we are not reporting, and there are things that the U.S. government is doing that we won't know for some time.
So on the ground in Ukraine, fierce fighting is raging at that steel plant in Mariupol as Russian forces mounted a final push to take the last bastion of resistance in the devastated city. A Ukrainian commander yesterday said, quote, heavy, bloody fighting is taking place inside that factory. Drone video here, shared by Ukraine's far-right Azov Regiment, shows thick smoke and multiple explosions at the complex. NBC News has not been able to independently verify when this video was shot. This as an advisor to Ukraine's internal affairs ministry alleged the Russians had breached the mill with the help of a former worker who knew the layout, including the tunnels and the bunkers inside. In his nightly address, President Volodymyr Zelensky reiterated that Russian shelling is nonstop, adding, quote, just imagine this hell. There are children. He also said that despite relentless attacks, Ukrainian fighters have refused to surrender. Meanwhile, the UN says an evacuation convoy is on its way to the plant and is hoping to evacuate more children today. We'll be following that. Also, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden is traveling to Europe to spend the holiday weekend on the Ukraine border, meeting with refugees. She left from Joint Base Andrews overnight. The four-day trip to Romania and Slovakia is her second solo international trip after leading the American delegation to the Summer Olympic Games. Dr. Biden's trip will include a special Mother's Day visit to a refugee checkpoint on the border of Ukraine. The First Lady will survey the site and tour a school for refugee children. Her trip follows a series of recent high-profile visits from U.S. officials. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi led a congressional delegation last week to Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. She met with Zelensky. The Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense also visited the capital city and did the same. President Biden was in Poland near the Ukrainian border in late March. Willie, the United States consistently over the course of time showing their support in many ways, including with these visits, which really shows symbolically that they are behind Ukraine.
Yeah, every week. Today, it's the First Lady of the United States. Last week, it was a congressional delegation led by Speaker Pelosi. Week before that, you had Secretaries Blinken and Austin there as well. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continues to speak to world leaders, both current and former. George W. Bush had high praise for the Ukrainian president after a conversation. The George Bush Presidential Center posted photos to social media of the two speaking virtually yesterday morning. Bush said he was honored to talk to Zelensky, whom he called the Winston Churchill of our time. He thanked the Ukrainian leader for his leadership, his example, and his commitment to liberty. The former president also saluted the Ukrainian people for their courage and said America will continue to stand with them as they fight to defend their freedom. So, Richard, Zelensky has masterfully reached out to foreign leaders, and including former foreign leaders like George W. Bush, kept in touch, addressed parliaments, addressed Congress, talked about exactly what he's going to need as this long war continues, and now sitting down with George W. Bush.
Look, it makes sense. In 2008, on George W. Bush's watch, that's when the process of potential NATO enlargement with with Ukraine was opened up at the Bucharest summit. It's the good news here. I'd say it's a rare moment of a degree of bipartisanship.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have a whole lot of that in foreign policy or anything else. The fact that many Republicans and obviously the administration and Democrats in Congress are all pushing the same way, good thing. The other thing this suggests is the other reason some of this intelligence may be coming out might be possible the administration wants it out. Early on, they were getting criticized for, quote unquote, not doing enough to help Ukraine. Clearly, we're doing a lot. You get the $33 billion package the president's proposed, all this intelligence support, the training. There's been a series of articles. Essentially, what the administration is doing is they have cast their lot. They've gone all in for Ukraine, and they may simply want it all now.
All right. Coming up on Morning Joe, former Defense Secretary Mark Esper recounts the moment Donald Trump asked whether the U.S. government could fire missiles into Mexico and then pretend it wasn't the U.S. who did it. Oh, my God. We'll dig into details of that stunning revelation. Plus, a look at where market futures stand this morning after the Dow plunged 1,000 points yesterday. Also ahead, we'll be joined by the chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries. We'll talk to him about his party's midterm messaging when it comes to abortion rights and what's the strategy. Also, new safety concerns about Johnson & Johnson's COVID vaccine. Why the FDA is now limiting the use of that shot. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
19 past the hour, the Food and Drug Administration is telling anyone 18 and older to not use the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine unless necessary. This follows the CDC's recommendation in December to get one of the other vaccines. Both agencies cite the risk of a rare and possibly fatal form of blood clot known as TTS. The FDA says through mid-March, it's confirmed 60 cases of it following a J&J shot, 9 of them deadly. To date, close to 19 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have been given in the U.S. We'll be following this. Rudy Giuliani, Trump's former personal lawyer, has canceled an interview with the January 6th committee that was slated for today. According to his attorney, he originally agreed to a transcribed interview, but told investigators he would not partake unless he was able to record it. The committee denied his request. In a statement, the committee spokesman called Giuliani an important witness to the conspiracy to overthrow the government, and that if he refuses to comply, the committee will consider all enforcement options. Giuliani was subpoenaed by the committee back in January, along with three other campaign attorneys linked with efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. Willie?
This morning, the New York Times is reporting former President Donald Trump once proposed using missiles to destroy drug labs in Mexico. It's one of the revelations in a new book from former Defense Secretary Mark Esper, titled A Sacred Oath. According to the Times, which obtained a copy of the memoir, quote, when Mr. Esper raised various objections, Mr. Trump said, we could just shoot some Patriot missiles and take out the labs quietly, adding, no one would know it was us. Mr. Trump said he would just say the United States had not conducted the strike. Mr. Esper recounts, writing, He would have thought it was a joke had he not been staring Mr. Trump in the face. The Times reports Trump also asked Secretary Esper if the military could put 10,000 active duty troops on the streets of Washington after protests and riots erupted in the wake of the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis. Referring to the demonstrators, former President Trump reportedly asked Esper, quote, "Can't you just shoot them?" Esper reportedly described Trump as a, quote, unprincipled person who, given his self-interest, should not be in the position of public service. You'll remember Esper was fired by Trump just days after the 2020 presidential election was called in favor of Joe Biden. We've reached out to former President Trump's team for comment. NBC News has not yet seen a copy of Esper's book. Secretary Esper will be our guest on Morning Joe next Tuesday. Mike Barnicle, so these are fascinating, perhaps unsurprising revelations, but it joins the list of former Trump administration officials who sort of found Jesus when the book deal comes.
Yeah, I mean, here's Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, who sits with the President of the United States, who just basically proves by his utterances to Mark Esper, who's quoted in Mr. Esper's book, that he is mentally unstable. What does Mark Esper do as Secretary of Defense? He goes back and shuts up about it until Random House or whatever the publisher was hands him a check. Oh, I got a good story for you. Please, just stop it. These people ought to be banned from coming on and promoting these books.
Well, you have a lot on Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah. Ask him about
that. Starting Wednesday, yes. What do you think, Richard?
Look, as a former administration official, I've worked for four presidents, there's certain things you have to keep quiet. That's part of the deal of when you go into administration. But when you see stuff that clearly is beyond the pale, against the law and so forth, you've got the duty, one, to push back privately. And if it's going to go ahead all the same, that's why you know, people should resign. They should resign in principle and explain it. And to simply sit on things that are clearly unacceptable, that presidents or officials ought not to be doing, I think, yeah, Mike's right. It raises fundamental questions about whether people have met their obligations. They don't work at the end of the day for the president as the person. They work for us.
Now, there is the argument, Mika, that we'll just put out there, and we look forward to talking to Secretary Esper on Tuesday about all this, that these men like General Milley, like various secretaries of various cabinets, if I leave, look who's behind me, that they had some duty to serve as a guardrail or a barrier to these things. The next guy might say, yeah, Donald Trump, you can launch missiles into Mexico and pretend it's not us.
I think it's impossible to understand what it was like to be in the shoes of someone who was working directly under President Trump. But Carol Lee, there are now countless stories of people coming out of that White House with even worse revelations than the ones we saw out loud. You know, the president didn't have much of a filter at the time and said the most inane, stupid, and dangerous things right on the world stage. I think stunning the media and desensitizing his constituents to what our values are. I mean, this is a man who spoke openly about shaking down Volodymyr Zelensky for dirt on Joe Biden. So I'm kind of with Mike Barnicle. I kind of wish somebody would have spoken out in real time.
Yeah, what's really interesting about this, Mika, is it echoes what former National Security Advisor John Bolton wrote, and what you, in the sense that the overarching theme, according to the New York Times story in Esper's book, is that it was all about for former President Trump's reelection, that everything was political, that his decisions were motivated by his own standing politically and his ambitions. And that's the lens through which we've seen a number of these stories be told through, is that that was the motivating factor. What's also striking is that, like John Bolton, Secretary Esper was at the forefront of some of the most serious decisions and things that were going on in any administration. He was the Secretary of Defense, and the way that he describes the president wanting to use the military and some of the president's aides, apparently, according to the New York Times story on the book, including Steve Miller sending 250,000 U.S. troops down to the border, things like that. What is also striking about this is that Esper talks about, to everyone's point, he talks about that he thought about resigning. In fact, we reported while he was still secretary that he had written a letter, a resignation letter that he would keep in around just in case. And he says the reason that he stayed is because President Trump was surrounded by yes men. Well, Esper's nickname, particularly on the Hill, was Yesper, because he was seen as somebody who just said yes to the president and didn't stand up to the president. And so part of what you're seeing here is, and we've seen these before, as everyone's noted, is this sort of reputation laundering book. And we'll see if it works. But the stories in here, setting aside the motivations and what Esper kept to himself, are really striking.
You know, Richard, you spoke about, you know, working for different presidents of both parties. And part of the depressing aspect of this tale from Mark Esper's book, and it's just the latest, as Carol pointed out, there have been others, is you wonder what happens to people who have some intellect, clearly, some experience, clearly. And what happens to them when they're in the Oval Office with the President of the United States? And do they not realize that the oath that they took to perform their duties is to the country? It's not to the president. And so these things occur repeatedly with different cabinet members. We've all read the confessions now. You wonder what happens to their courage and their sense of what this country is all about.
It's a great story by Bob Strauss, who is, you know, Mr. Democrat, Mr. Yeah. Politics from Texas. He was against the war, had growing doubts against the war in Vietnam. He finally gets an audience with Lyndon Johnson, and he goes in there determined to tell Lyndon Johnson why the Vietnam War is a mistake. He gets in the Oval Office, and his courage deserts him. He gets the Lyndon Johnson treatment, and by the end of the meeting, he's saying, Mr. President, you're doing a great job. He then says he went afterwards back home, took a shower, felt humiliated by what he hadn't done, and he promised if he ever got a chance to meet with an American president again, he would never do that. He would always tell the truth from that point on, and he did.
NBC News White House correspondent Carol Lee, that nickname Yesper is painful. Thank you very much for being on this morning. Okay. We'll be asking about that. And coming up, we're headed to Wall Street for an early look at the markets after the worst trading day since the start of the pandemic. Plus, incoming Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson takes the bench at a tumultuous time for the High Court following the leak of a draft opinion to overturn Roe v. Wade. Eugene Robinson says Judge Jackson must wonder what she's gotten herself into. Gene joins us next with his latest column for The Washington Post. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Past the hour. It's Friday morning and the start of a rainy weekend in New York City as we take a live look at the top of the Rock. All right, let's talk about something else that's kind of gloomy. Growing concerns about the state of the U.S. economy after whiplash on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 1,000 points yesterday, its worst day since 2020. It wiped out a huge rally on Wednesday after Fed Reserve Chair Jerome Powell helped reassure investors. He said the Fed was unlikely to raise interest rates as aggressively as many on Wall Street expected. Joining us now, CNBC reporter Frank Holland with more on this. First of all, just talk about the drop yesterday. What are we expecting today?
Well, I mean, right now, futures are down slightly, not down big. But after yesterday, you know, it's kind of an anything goes environment. We've been talking to people all morning here on CNBC. A lot of thoughts about that jobs report that's coming up later today. Mm-hmm. Could be a factor on the markets, may not be a factor on the markets. I think you were really just breaking down pretty well. When Fed Chair Jay Powell said the Fed is not actively considering a 75-point hike in June, well, at first, the markets really responded well on Wednesday. We saw a big rally. And then a lot of people think people slept on it and said, hey, wait a minute. What did he mean by not actively considering? So kind of that old Dumb and Dumber joke, are you saying there's a chance? And that's really creating a lot of uncertainty on the markets today.
So you mentioned the jobs report, which is coming out at 8:30 Eastern time. We'll, of course, bring those numbers live. But, Frank, what will we be looking for in those numbers?
Well, right now, economists are expecting an increase of 400,000 jobs for the month of April. That's actually a slight decrease in the growth that we saw back in March of 431,000 jobs. We also know on Tuesday, we learned there's about 5.5 million more jobs than workers here in the U.S. as a almost record number of people quit their jobs. So the question is, where can we actually see growth? We see gains in hospitality and travel. To many, that'd be a sign of an economy that's continued to strengthen. If those sectors have issues finding workers, or we actually see reductions in workers in some of those areas, well, a lot of questions about the growth.
All right, CNBC's Frank Holland, thank you very much. Willie?
All right, time now, Mika, for some must-read opinion pages. Joining us is Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and associate editor of The Washington Post and MSNBC political analyst Eugene Robinson, and the associate editor of Commentary Magazine, also an MSNBC contributor, Noah Rothman. Guys, good morning to you both. Noah, congratulations on keeping the pandemic beard at the insistence of your wife, although you're not sure how to take that, I guess.
Well, it's a compliment, I suppose, because now I'm more attractive than I was before.
Right.
According to her. So, I'm going to look at it in the bright side.
Cover a little more of your face is what she's asking you. Well, it looks good, Noah. It looks
good. Thank you so much.
All right, let's start with Noah's new piece for Commentary titled, "The GOP Can Still Blow It." Noah writes about even heavily favored candidates can quickly shift based on who's running. You write in part, quote, "Robert R.J. Regan should have cruised to victory in a district that voted Republican by 26 points and which Donald Trump won by 16 points in 2020. The primary is all that should have mattered. But on Tuesday night, Regan lost a special election to his Democratic opponent, and it wasn't particularly close. This cautionary tale could have broader relevance with primary season now fully upon us. In Tuesday's Senate primary race in Ohio, Trump-endorsed candidate J.D. Vance emerged victorious. It's entirely unclear which Vance Ohio's Republicans will get for their votes. The thoughtful Ivy League-educated author and elite lawyer with somewhat nationalist sensibilities, or the ideologically malleable provocateur who never met a fringe figure he wouldn't legitimize. Whether Vance believes what he says or not, he has also spelunked down the same lunatic rabbit holes into which Regan consigned his political career. J.D. Vance is not Robert Regan, and the state of Ohio is not Michigan's 74th House district. Vance is the favorite to win his race in November, but so too was Regan. The last thing the GOP should want is for local races to become referenda on individual candidates rather than an up or down vote on the Democrats' record in office. Despite the many advantages Republicans enjoy today, a bad candidate can still lose a winnable race, which is always true, Noah. J.D. Vance is an interesting case. As you say, he was one guy for a long time. He's now presented himself as this Trump-loyal Republican, having people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Don Jr., Matt Gaetz in to close the deal for him in the state of Ohio. Ohio voters seem to like J.D. Vance, at least in the Republican primary. Do you believe he can blow it the way you say some other candidates can?
I think he can. I think he has much better prospects. Yeah. Ohio is a redder state. He's a smart candidate. He's a smart guy. I think he can present himself as an electable figure in a way that perhaps papers over some of the statements that he made on the campaign trail as a primary candidate. But those statements that he did make ranged from just paranoia to the incandescently stupid. The notion here that we have fentanyl, he's talked about the idea that fentanyl is a conspiracy designed to kill MAGA voters. And that's just a quote. I'm not making that up. The idea that the border crisis has been engineered in order to punish people that the president does not like. These are the sort of statements that haunt you. The issue set that Republicans should face or should be, you know, touting are blindingly obvious. It's the economy. It's cost of living. It's general incompetence in Washington and the president's record in office and Democrats' record in office, unified the last year and a half of government. Anything off that message is off message. It's off brand. And it's the sort of thing that can alienate the kind of voters that you need to win. A bad candidate can lose a race, even in good partisan territory, even in a good political environment, or else we'd be calling Sharon Engel, Roy Moore, Todd Akin, Senator. These are the sort of things that can swamp a candidate and can make the candidate the issue rather than the political environment. That's what we should be voting on.
So, Noah, can you give us an autopsy on how Regan lost? How crazy was he out there? What did he say? What did he do?
That's sort of the general stuff that really is attractive to the very online right. And if you're steeped in that environment, you can think that it has broader purchase. The sort of, obviously, 2020. Relitigating 2020, somehow using some mechanism to avenge that loss and, you know, wave the bloody tunic of Trump's presidency. Vaccine skepticism is another. Made some flippant comments about rape, and which is going to become a big issue for candidates after in the event that we end up overturning Roe. That there's a lot of Republicans who could put their foot in their mouth by saying things on abortion that reflect sentiments that are popular on the online right, but are broadly. That the American electorate is broadly hostile to. And, of course, if you're a paranoiac, a favorite, dabbling in a little bit of anti-Semitism. He called feminism a plot conceived by Jews.
Yeah, he said it's a Jewish program to degrade and subjugate white men.
Yeah.
That's how he described feminism.
This is crazy. It's crazy talk, right? And even if you genuinely believe that, and I don't think anybody should, but if you genuinely do, it's incredibly foolish to give voice to it, to pretend as though these sentiments have broader purchase. And if you think they do, then you're not representing the people you should be representing. In that district, he lost not only by 12 points in a very red district, but 8% of voters wrote in a protest vote. They just couldn't bring themselves to vote for this guy. And we've seen this time and time again, particularly on the Republican side, when primary voters elevate bad candidates to in places where they should win, like Alabama. You can lose.
The bloody tunic of the Trump presidency.
Yeah, and Gene Robinson, this is the central issue for many of these candidates is the 2020 election. Still, an election almost 2 years ago, Regan and others sort of positioned themselves as these rabid defenders of Donald Trump and that they tried to decertify the results and keep Joe Biden from office. J.D. Vance espoused the same argument. There was one candidate in the race in Ohio who refused to do that part, at least, and he lost. There's an interesting snapshot of that case in the state of Georgia, where an incumbent governor, Brian Kemp, is up against David Perdue, who leads every conversation, every debate with the election was stolen in 2020. He, though, is down by 25 points. So it's a case by case thing.
It's a case by case thing. But look, that may be what the most involved and online Republican primary voters want to hear. And it may fire them up and it may get you a nomination. I don't believe that's what the general election electorate wants to hear. They'll think that that's crazy because it is crazy. It is. We know what happened in 2020, and most Americans know what happened in 2020. And it's going to get a lot of these candidates in trouble, I think. I mean, I think J.D. Vance absolutely can blow a race that on paper you would say he ought to win. I think he certainly can lose that race in Ohio, and I think you know, his Democratic opponent Tim Ryan is happy every time Vance strays onto that, you know, that far right, loony right path.
Well, and now we have the issue of abortion that has been thrust into the, you know, run up to the midterms. Gene, in your latest op-ed for the Washington Post is entitled Ketanji Brown Jackson Must Wonder What She Has Gotten Herself Into. And you write in part, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson must be having second thoughts when she takes her seat on the Supreme Court. She will be joining an institution whose out of control majority values religious dogma and raw political power over the freedoms our Constitution is supposed to guarantee. And she'll become a junior member of a club that increasingly seems riven by animosity. Justices Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Samuel Alito are in charge and will be effectively running the court for years to come. Jackson will probably enjoy pleasantly collegial relationships with some or all of them. If she is as smart and skilled a jurist as she seemed during her confirmation hearings, she might even occasionally persuade one or more of them to agree with her analysis on an issue. Realistically, though, she must know that at least until the court's roster changes, on most hot-button cases, she will be limited to deciding how passionate her dissenting opinion should be. And, Jean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's the reality inside the court. And the reality that she's entering right now is also there's an investigation underway. There's this unprecedented leak. Trust in the court, trust within the court is broken. And that's going to be fascinating to watch play out as they try and determine how this draft opinion was leaked. But then there's the Democrats and how they play this in the midterms. Because I got to tell you, Chuck Schumer doing this vote to codify abortion rights, to have two Republican senators at least, you know, not and to show their vote because there's some religious institutions that wouldn't be exempt from this and therefore they won't vote. I just don't know what it does. I think that's noise to people. I think there's a better way possibly to talk to Americans about this constitutional right that appears to be taken away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think, and I assume that Democrats will find a way to communicate this message to Americans, because this is a huge, huge deal. I mean, this, if you read Justice Alito's draft opinion, he says it's just about Roe. It doesn't affect other landmark decisions. But his reasoning absolutely puts those many other decisions in the crosshairs of this court, including the decision that guaranteed the right to contraception, the decision that voided laws that outlawed consensual sexual relations between people of the same sex, the decision that the Obergefell decision that legalized gay marriage nationwide. Those decisions rested on the same logic and reasoning mm-hmm. of Roe and cited Roe. And so if you get rid of Roe v. Wade, they're just standing out there without support. I guarantee they're going to be challenged. And what is this court going to do? There is not a logical way to that you can strike down Roe and you can uphold all these other rulings, I think. I'm not a lawyer, but I've read a lot of court decisions. This is a powerful message, I think. Even if you just stick to Roe, this is a decision that affects, you know, more than half the American population, in a very visceral, personal way, and affects really all Americans in a substantial way, and it is way out of step with where public opinion is. I realize that public opinion on abortion is more nuanced than some people will give it credit to be, but it is not where the Alito decision is. And right. So I think this is a powerful issue for Democrats that changes these races, changes these midterm elections in a transformative way. And we'll just have to see what happens. But this, you know, sometimes you say this changes everything and it really doesn't. This does change everything.
In that political context Gene's talking about, it's been fascinating to watch Republicans handle this story over the last few days. They've achieved, it appears, the Holy Grail, 50 years fighting to pull back Roe versus Wade. And yet the messaging from leadership all the way down is this is a story about the leak. It undermines the Supreme Court, one of the last institutions we thought we could trust, and it was above politics. They don't necessarily want to talk about the substance of what happens next, because outright banning abortion is flatly unpopular in this country.
It is. I think actually Republicans in Washington have played this pretty smartly. First of all, there's this idea abroad that this has not happened yet. So it's smart to keep your powder dry for when it does, because then we could be having arguments about things that may not occur. So that's wise on their part. Second, there's an idea abroad that talking about this leak, which is serious, the first time in history we got a draft opinion designed either to influence proceedings in the court or to undermine the institution, is something we should talk about and take very seriously. The idea that it somehow undermines the overturning of Roe or overshadows or eclipses this is crazy talk. Right. That's a crazy idea. Nothing's going to overshadow Row. We can spend 2 days talking
about
this.
But that's what Republicans explicitly have said. When Mitch McConnell's asked about it, he said, that's not the story. The story is the leak. And you ask him about the substance. The story is the leak.
It's not going to be the leak when the decision comes out, though. And when the decision comes out, we'll talk about this. I'm not a lawyer either. With respect to Gene, I do think there's a way that Republicans can talk about this, particularly the idea that because Roe was decided in a, it was decided in a way that drew these rights from not only the Bill of Rights, but the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. It was so torturously decided that it does bring into account all these other equal protection rights that shouldn't be a part of the conversation. I think they can talk about that. Second, Republicans would be smart to defer to the court's logic and remand this issue to the states. If they play into the idea that this is an issue for the federal legislature, that's exactly the territory that Democrats want to fight them on. They want this to be a federal issue. Republicans should say this is a state's issue. Courts decided this has nothing to do with us, especially on the federal level. We're out of it.
Gene, we'll give you a last word on this.
Well, I don't think that's going to work. I mean, because this is a right that has been guaranteed for 50 years nationwide, and yes, there has been a constant fight about it, and that fight will continue whichever way this decision comes out. But I don't think you can unring that bell. And I really think that going back to a state by state patchwork set of different abortion laws where it's completely banned in one state and across the border, it's completely allowed, it is not workable. It's just not workable, I think, in today's America, and this is going to be a very, very big deal politically, potentially for the rest of our lives. We're going to be fighting over this
decision in June, likely, and we'll see how it plays in the fall. Eugene Robinson and Noah Rothman, great to see you both. Thanks so much. Coming up here, the New York Mets pull off their biggest comeback in 25 years. Had even Mike Barnicle rooting for the Mets last night.
Yeah.
And a performance at Fenway Park not seen since the days of Babe Ruth.
Oh, stop it.
A look at a historic day in Major League Baseball next on Morning Joe.
And Starling unloads one deep left center. Back to the warning track goes Herrera near the wall. It's off the base. Here's Nimmo around third. He'll come in to score, and the Mets take the lead. Unbelievable.
Starling Marte with the RBI double that capped a seven-run ninth-inning rally. Bring the New York Mets back from six down at the start of that inning. It marks the Mets' largest ninth-inning comeback in a quarter of a century. They hung on to beat the Phillies 8-7 and add a major league-leading 19th victory to their win column. In Boston, we saw a two-way performance at Fenway, not seen since the days of Babe Ruth. Pitching at the historic ballpark for the very first time, the Angels superstar Shohei Ohtani struck out 11 batters in seven shutout innings on the mound. Ohtani, batting third in the lineup, added two hits from the plate as well, including this RBI single smoked off the Green Monster in left field that knocked his own number 17 off the scoreboard. The Angels beat the Red Sox 8-0, the loss sinking Boston to a last-place tie in the American League East with the Baltimore Orioles. The first-place Yankees had the night off. First-place Yankees, last-place Red Sox. For now, Yankees had the night off, so they were at the Garden, taking in the New York Rangers' first-round win against the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Owned by the Boston Red Sox.
Look at that. Look at that. Just hammering down Rizzo, Judge, DJ LeMahieu, pounding beers on the Jumbotron. Mike, where do you want to start? Let's start happy with the Mets. The Mets are great. They're fun. They're having a great season.
You know, flipping through the channels last night, as you know.
Trying to keep them away from the Red Sox.
I have no wife, so I'm looking for baseball games. I get the Mets, top of the ninth. They're down 7-1. No-name people. I mean, Lindor hits a home run to lead off the top of the ninth. He's a big star. J.D. Davis, Brandon Nimmo, key base hits and everything there. If they come back and win that game, they are a fun team to watch, a really fun team to watch.
He was so excited. He went on the Twitter machine.
He did. You tweeted in favor of the Mets. A rare tweet from Mike Barnacle.
You know, I will tell you something. I didn't tweet out about the Mets. Halfway through the tweet, I'm thinking, how stupid is this that I'm doing this? But on the other guy.
Yeah. Otani.
He is unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable.
He is an absolutely legitimate reason to buy a ticket to go and
watch
a baseball game. 85% of the pitches he threw yesterday, as I watched, 85% were strikes.
Unreal.
Incredible.
They couldn't.
98, 99 miles an hour. Boom.
And then to come out and hit third in the lineup and hit as well as he does. Richard, we just, in our lifetimes, we have not seen it.
No, it's, I mean, there's a couple of reasons to watch baseball. He's number one. Mike Trout, number two. There are some players today who are as good as we've ever seen.
Absolutely.
It's a real treat.
It is. And for now, what are we, 24, 5 games into the season? Richard, our Yankees, for now, look great. Injuries are coming. We know that.
I know, but the idea of a Subway Series, I mean, really, come on. You can almost feel it. You can almost feel it.
No, I can't.
I just.
Mike is mourning this morning, Nika.
Richard needs to stick to golf or maybe just foreign policy.
Phil Mickelson, big story, making $40 million.
Great.
He's reported to have lost in betting. $40
million.
What do you think about this new golf league they want to put together over in Saudi Arabia?
They are putting it together.
Greed on the part of the players, so-called sports washing. The Saudis are looking for this as a way to cleanse their reputation.
And they got some big names playing along, Mika.
That's a big sand trap.
There we go, Mika.
There's actually a connection between golf and foreign policy there. Richard, well done. Well done. Good job, kid. We're going to give you another chance.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.